Picture this. It is 7:30 in the morning. The sun is barely done yawning. Birds are doing their little bird things outside the window. And inside Ashford Manor, one of the most breathtaking estates in all of the English countryside, with its stone columns and its ivy climbing the walls like it too is trying to escape, a woman is standing in the hallway outside the master bedroom, holding a silver breakfast tray, listening to the sound of two people laughing on the other side of the door. Two people. In her bedroom. In her bed. She sets the tray down on the hall table very carefully. Not because she is trembling. Not because she is about to cry. She sets it down carefully because the china is old, it belonged to her grandmother, and she has absolutely no intention of letting this be the reason something precious breaks today. Her name is Eloan Ashford, née Cavendish. Duchess of Blackmore. 28 years old. 5'6" of composed, measured, unflinching elegance. The kind of woman who reads 3 newspapers before breakfast and remembers everything she has ever read. The kind of woman who once talked a hostile foreign diplomat into a trade agreement over the course of a single dinner party. The kind of woman who, when she was 16 and her horse threw her at a county fair in front of 500 people, stood up, dusted off her riding coat, walked back to that horse, mounted it again, and won the race. She is not the kind of woman you betray. Someone should have told the Duke that. His name is Edmund Ashford. Duke of Blackmore. 32 years old. Handsome in that irritating way that gets men into far more trouble than they are equipped to handle. Broad shoulders. A jaw that looked like it had been personally chiseled by someone who wanted the world to be unfair. The kind of man who walked into a room and immediately became the room's problem. Charming, magnetic, politically connected, and, as Eloan had been discovering in slow, excruciating detail over the past 11 months, catastrophically stupid in the specific way that only truly arrogant men manage to be. He had been seeing Lady Cecily Montrose for almost a year. Lady Cecily. Red hair. 17 different kinds of laugh, each one louder than the last. A talent for being in whatever room Edmund happened to walk into, as though the universe itself was her personal social secretary. She wore her ambition like perfume, you could smell it from across the garden, and she had set her sights on the Duchess's life with the focused intensity of a woman who had never once been told no by anyone who mattered. Eloan had known about the affair for 8 months. 8 months. She had not cried. She had not confronted Edmund in a tearful midnight hallway scene. She had not written Lady Cecily a scathing letter. She had not confided in her mother, who would have immediately deployed the kind of social warfare that left entire family lines smoking in the rubble. Instead, she had gone very quiet. She had started taking long walks in the morning. She had begun attending her solicitor's offices on Tuesdays, which Edmund assumed was something to do with her charitable work, because he had never once paid attention to her charitable work. She had started going through the estate ledgers herself, which she hadn't done since the first year of their marriage, because Edmund had a man of business and she had trusted that man. She had started reviewing the marriage contracts, the inheritance documents, the property deeds, the trust structures that her father, the late Viscount Cavendish, had assembled with the quiet ferocity of a man who had known, perhaps better than anyone, that the world was not reliably kind to women. She had been building something. And she had been waiting. Not out of patience. Not out of hope that Edmund would come to his senses. She was past hope the way a person is past a city they've already driven through. She could see it in the rearview, getting smaller. She had been waiting because timing, as her father had always told her, is the difference between a scandal and a catastrophe. And Eloan Cavendish, even in her married name, even in someone else's house, had always known how to make a catastrophe work for her. Now, standing in the hallway, listening to the laughter that floated under the door like smoke from a fire someone else started, she understood that the timing had arrived. She picked up the breakfast tray. She walked downstairs. She instructed cook to prepare a second breakfast, more elaborate than the first, and to have it sent to the blue drawing room. Then she sat down at the writing desk in her private sitting room, opened the drawer, removed a letter she had written 3 weeks ago and sealed in an envelope, and placed it on top of a stack of documents she had been assembling with the care of a surgeon preparing for a procedure she had been practicing her whole life. She looked at the stack for a moment. Then she smiled. Not the polite smile. Not the social smile she wore to dinner parties and charity balls and parliamentary dinners where she was expected to decorate the room and add nothing to the conversation. The other smile. The one that lived much deeper and came out much less often. The one that meant ready. Before we go any further, I need you to understand something. Because there is a version of this story where Eloan is simply a clever woman who got lucky with good paperwork. And that version is wrong. It is so wrong it deserves to be corrected with some force. Eloan was not lucky. Luck is what you call someone else's preparation when you weren't there to see the work. What she was, and this matters, this is the whole point, was prepared. She was the kind of prepared that doesn't look like preparation from the outside because it looks like a woman going quietly about her life. She was the kind of prepared that takes years to build and minutes to deploy. She was the kind of prepared that the world, and specifically the world that Edmund Ashford lived in, does not expect from a woman, which is precisely what made it so completely, so beautifully, so terminally effective. People underestimate quietness. They mistake it for passivity. They see a woman who does not make scenes and assume she has nothing to say. They see a woman who appears to accept things and assume she is accepting them. They see a woman who reads documents at a writing desk and assume she is filling her time. They are always wrong. And so was Edmund. Now, before we get to what happened next, and I promise you, what happened next is going to make your jaw drop, bounce off the floor, roll under the furniture, and require retrieval, we need to go back. Because you cannot fully appreciate what Eloan had built without understanding what she started with, and what she had been dismantling piece by piece while Edmund thought she was simply being a good, quiet wife. Eloan Cavendish had grown up in a household shaped entirely by her father's philosophy, which could be summarized as follows: information is the only currency that doesn't devalue, and a woman who controls her own paperwork controls her own fate. Viscount Cavendish had been a man of modest title and immodest intellect. He had four daughters and no sons, which in their social world was the specific kind of tragedy that made men fold. He had refused to fold. Instead, he had done something deeply radical for a Victorian aristocrat. He had educated all four daughters identically, hired them the same tutors, sat them at the same table for the same lessons, and treated their questions with the same patience and seriousness he would have given any son. Eloan had been his sharpest student. Not because she was brilliant in the dazzling, theatrical way, she wasn't the kind of person who performed intelligence. She was brilliant in the relentless, patient way. She understood systems. She understood how things connected, how one piece of paper affected another piece of paper, how a single clause in a contract could be either a wall or a door depending entirely on who was reading it and when. There was a particular Tuesday in May, in the second year of the marriage, when Eloan had gone into Edmund's study to retrieve a book she'd left there and had found, folded inside the book, a letter she was not meant to see. She had not intended to read it. She had looked at it the way you sometimes look at something before you understand what you're looking at, and by the time her brain caught up with her eyes she had read the first three lines. Three lines was enough. The letter was from a woman. The tone was unmistakable. The familiarity in it, the easy, intimate shorthand of people who have been close long enough to drop pretense, was the kind of thing you could not misinterpret. She stood in Edmund's study for 45 seconds, holding the book, holding the letter, and then she very carefully replaced the letter exactly as she'd found it, returned the book to the shelf, and walked out. She said nothing to Edmund that evening. Or that week. She went about her life with the composed deliberateness that her father had always called her greatest quality, now deployed in a situation she had never imagined it would be required for. It had been a first incident. She had not known then how long it would continue. She had hoped, in the way you hope for things when you are 25 and still capable of it, that it was brief, a mistake, finished. It was not finished. Over 6 years, she had found evidence of four separate women. Not simultaneous, as far as she could determine, Edmund was many things but he appeared to value simplicity in his complications, which if nothing else kept her filing manageable. The last and most persistent was Lady Cecily. The one who had apparently decided that an affair was merely an engagement running slightly behind schedule, and that the only bureaucratic obstacle between herself and the Duchess's life was the Duchess herself, who would surely, eventually, crumble under the weight of being ignored. Cecily had done her research. She had attended the right events. She had positioned herself in Edmund's orbit with the architectural precision of someone who had studied the blueprints. She had, through 6 months of careful maneuvering, made herself indispensable to his social world, which was the world he cared most about, and then inevitable to his private one. What she had not done, what nobody seemed to have thought to do, was research Eloan. This is, in retrospect, an astonishing oversight. The woman you are planning to displace is generally the first person you should understand completely. You want to know what she values, what she has, what she is capable of. You want to know whether she is the kind of woman who will weep and fold and leave the field to you, or whether she is the kind of woman who will say nothing for 8 months while quietly building a legal fortress around every asset she owns. Cecily had apparently assumed the former. Eloan had always been the latter. When she married Edmund at 23, she had read the marriage contract herself. All 47 pages. She had flagged three clauses her solicitor had missed, one of which was quite important, and she had insisted on amendments before she signed. Edmund had found this mildly amusing, in the slightly condescending way of a man who has never once been outmaneuvered. His own solicitor had suggested she was being thorough. Eloan had said nothing. She had simply signed the amended version and filed her copy where she could find it. That copy was now at the top of her stack. She had also, and this is the part that is going to require a moment of appreciation, spent the past 8 months doing something that Edmund's very expensive solicitors had not thought to do, because they were working for Edmund and therefore not particularly interested in what might happen if everything went wrong for Edmund. She had been quietly, methodically, transferring the management of every asset that was legally, under the terms of that amended marriage contract, hers. Her dowry, which had been considerable, had been placed in trust at the time of marriage, her father's insistence, which Edmund's family had grumbled about and ultimately accepted because the Cavendish social connections were worth more than the inconvenience. That trust had specific conditions. It had a trustee who was not Edmund. It had reversion clauses. It had, buried in page 31, a single sentence that Eloan had put there herself, suggested to her solicitor as a minor clarification, that gave her the right to direct the trust's investments without spousal approval under circumstances that included, and this is the sentence, evidence of marital abandonment. She had 8 months of evidence. Affidavits from three members of household staff, taken voluntarily, entirely legal, and sitting in a safety deposit box at the bank in town. The deed to Cavendish House, her childhood home, which had reverted to her upon her father's death 2 years ago. It was in her name alone. It always had been. Edmund had never thought to check because Edmund had never thought about anything that didn't directly require his attention in the moment. Shares in two railway companies and a textile concern, originally gifted to her by her father, reinvested and grown quietly over 5 years while Edmund was busy being charming at other people's dinner tables. And, the crown jewel, the piece de resistance, the move that would make his solicitors weep quietly into their port, the letter. 3 weeks before this particular morning, Eloan had received a visit from a Mr. Augustus Pemberton, who was the senior partner of Pemberton and Associates, who were the solicitors of record for the Blackmore estate. Not Edmund's personal solicitors. The estate's solicitors. The distinction mattered. Mr. Pemberton had come to discuss a matter of some delicacy. It had come to his attention, through channels he declined to specify, that the management accounts for the Eastern Agricultural Holdings, Edmund's primary income-generating asset, had not been properly reconciled in 4 years. Not because anyone was stealing, necessarily. Because Edmund's man of business, a Mr. Harold Fitch, had been, how to put this, aggressively optimistic in his projections and aggressively quiet about his losses, and the gap between what the estates were reported to be earning and what they were actually earning had grown into a canyon that was going to become very, very visible as soon as anyone looked directly at it. Mr. Pemberton had come to the Duchess because, under the terms of the estate trust, another amended document, another minor clarification, another sentence buried in page 44 that Edmund had never read, she was a co-trustee. Had been since year two of the marriage, when Edmund had asked her to sign some papers he described as administrative, and she had read all 40 pages before signing. She was a co-trustee, and Mr. Pemberton needed her signature to proceed with an external audit. Eloan had given him the signature. She had also given him, very quietly, the address of an independent agricultural assessor she happened to know, and suggested that a current valuation of the Eastern Holdings might be prudent alongside the audit. That assessment had come back last Tuesday. The Eastern Holdings, which Edmund had been using as collateral for a series of social investments, meaning clubs, horses, and the extremely expensive tastes of a certain red-haired lady who liked French fashion and Italian jewels, were worth significantly less than what Edmund owed against them. Edmund did not know this yet. He was upstairs, laughing. She had 8 months of evidence. Affidavits from three members of household staff, taken voluntarily, entirely legal, and sitting in a safety deposit box at the bank in town. Let's pause here for a moment on the staff. Because the staff of Ashford Manor were, collectively, a deeply important variable in this story, and they deserve better than a footnote. Mrs. Alderton had worked at Ashford Manor for 22 years. She had served Edmund's father before Edmund, and when Edmund inherited the title and the estate and the house, she had stayed. She had been, for most of Edmund's adult life, the person who actually kept everything running, including aspects of his life he was not aware required running. She had a memory like a court filing system and a moral compass that needed no calibration. She also had, developed over 2 decades of domestic service, an extremely finely tuned understanding of character, who was worth following, who was not, and what it meant when the balance shifted. She had made her assessment of the Duchess in the first week of the marriage, watching a 23-year-old woman arrive at an enormous, unfamiliar house, be introduced to 50 members of staff in a single afternoon, and remember every single name without being prompted. Not a party trick. Not showing off. She'd simply remembered, and used the names correctly, and treated each person as a person rather than a function, which in Mrs. Alderton's 22 years of experience put her in the top 3 of any household she'd served. Thomas, the head footman, had his own reason for loyalty to the Duchess. 3 years into the marriage, his younger brother had come to work at the manor as a stable boy, and had gotten his leg badly broken in an accident with a spooked horse. Edmund had been out of the country. The bill for the surgeon had been significant. The Duchess had paid it without being asked, from her personal accounts, with specific instructions that it was not to be mentioned to the Duke, that it was not a loan, and that Thomas's brother was to have the time he needed to recover properly before returning to any work. Thomas had not forgotten. And Jenny, one of the senior housemaids, had been with the house for 4 years and had spent a meaningful portion of those years listening to things through the high ceilings and thin walls of a historic manor house that was not, acoustically, designed for discretion. She had information. She had always had information. What she had not had, until 8 months ago, was a Duchess who came to her quietly and asked for it with the specific, careful seriousness of a woman who was not going to do anything careless with what she received. Jenny had given her statement to Mr. House Clerk on a Tuesday afternoon in February, sitting in the small parlor of the solicitor's office in town, and she had been clear and specific and exactly as detailed as the situation required. She had then gone back to Ashford Manor, gone about her duties, and not said a single word to anyone about it, including Mrs. Alderton, because the Duchess had asked for discretion and Jenny believed in honoring reasonable requests. These 3 people, Mrs. Alderton, Thomas, Jenny, were not conspiring against Edmund out of malice. They were simply choosing, when the moment came, who they owed their loyalty to. And they had each, independently, arrived at the same answer, the person who had treated them as people rather than furniture. Which was not Edmund. Edmund, for his part, had spent the 8 months of Eloan's preparation doing what Edmund generally did, which was moving through the world as though it was designed for his convenience and tended to arrange itself around his requirements. He was in London more than he was in the country. He attended his clubs. He went to the races. He appeared at the events that mattered for his social maintenance. He had dinner with Cecily, not always in public, sometimes with an elaborate fiction about where he was and why, which he constructed with the lazy confidence of a man who has never been seriously questioned and therefore has never felt the need to be careful. He also, and this is where it becomes genuinely, almost comically ironic, spent a considerable amount of time during those 8 months talking about how smoothly his household ran. How capable Eloan was. How she managed the domestic side of things so efficiently that he really never had to think about it. He said this, apparently without irony, to at least 2 friends who reported it later with the expression of people trying not to wince in real time. The household ran efficiently because Eloan was running it. The accounts were in order because Eloan had been reviewing them. The staff were loyal because Eloan had earned their loyalty. And the legal situation was entirely in hand because Eloan had been quietly, methodically, ensuring that it was. Edmund talked about what she managed. He simply had no idea what managing it required, or what happened when the person doing it decided to manage it somewhere else. He was about to find out. The morning after the library meeting, which is to say, the morning after Eloan had sat down 3 solicitors and reordered the financial geography of everything Edmund had assumed was permanent, Edmund woke up at 7 in a bed that was now definitively, entirely his and felt the first full weight of what had happened. Not the details. He understood the details. He had sat in that library for 3 hours having the details explained to him with the clarity of a surgical procedure performed by very good surgeons. What he felt now, in the quiet of the morning, was the shape of the thing, the actual shape of what he had done and what had been done in response, and the way those two things fit together with a precision that was almost admirable. She had not been waiting for him to stop. She had not been hoping he would change. She had not been gathering evidence so that she could confront him emotionally and demand he choose. She had been building a future. An alternative. A complete, structurally sound, legally protected life that did not require him in any of the essential functions. He lay in the ceiling light for a long time and thought about what that meant. It meant, among other things, that she had known. She had known for long enough to prepare all of this. Which meant she had been living alongside him, managing his household, attending his events, sitting across from him at dinners and breakfasts and evenings in the drawing room, while knowing, and saying nothing, and building. He tried to remember the last 8 months. Tried to identify the moments when she might have been different, when something might have shown. He couldn't find them. She had been exactly herself. Composed, capable, present, managing everything that needed managing. The woman he had been most likely to describe, in company, as a remarkably steady sort of person. Which he had meant as a compliment, in his way. Which she had apparently taken as something else entirely. He got up. He dressed. He went downstairs. The morning room contained Cook's finest production, because Cook did not yet know what was happening and had simply performed her morning duties with her usual excellence. Edmund sat down to an excellent breakfast that tasted of absolutely nothing and stared at the door through which his wife had disappeared yesterday afternoon and thought about the word exceptional. His new solicitor had used it. Exceptional thoroughness. He had said it like a verdict. Edmund supposed it was. Back to that morning. At approximately 9:15, the master bedroom door opened, and Lady Cecily Montrose emerged into the hallway in a dressing gown, the Duchess's dressing gown, the blue silk one with the ivory trim, and padded down the hall toward the guest bathroom with the casual entitlement of a woman who has decided that someone else's home is now her home and is simply waiting for the paperwork to catch up. She did not see Mrs. Alderton, the housekeeper, standing at the end of the corridor. Mrs. Alderton, who had been with the household for 22 years and had served the Duchess's mother before that, watched Lady Cecily disappear into the bathroom with an expression that could have curdled milk at 50 paces. Mrs. Alderton went downstairs and found Eloan in her sitting room. She said, without preamble, "She's wearing your dressing gown, Your Grace." Eloan looked up from her correspondence. "I know. The blue one. I know, Mrs. Alderton. The one your mother gave you. I'm aware." A pause. Mrs. Alderton was visibly vibrating. "Shall I?" "No," Eloan said pleasantly. "Leave everything exactly as it is. In fact, please ensure that Lady Cecily's morning requirements are met with every courtesy. Tea, if she wants it. Breakfast, if she asks. I want her to be extremely comfortable." Mrs. Alderton stared. "You want her to be comfortable?" "Extremely. Your Grace, with the greatest respect. Mrs. Alderton." Eloan looked up fully. "Trust me." Mrs. Alderton had trusted the Duchess for 6 years. She had watched her manage impossible dinner parties, navigate vicious social politics, and once, memorably, redirect an entire charitable fundraiser when the guest of honor arrived 3 hours late and drunk. She pressed her lips together, gave a single sharp nod, and went back upstairs to be professionally pleasant to the woman wearing her employer's dressing gown. At 10 o'clock, Edmund came downstairs. He found Eloan in the morning room, seated at the table, reading a letter with the focused attention she gave everything. She was dressed impeccably, as always, a pale green walking dress, hair arranged without a single strand out of place. She looked, to anyone watching, like a woman spending a perfectly ordinary Tuesday morning reading her correspondence. Edmund stopped in the doorway, and for just a moment, the smallest flicker, something moved across his face. Not quite guilt. Men like Edmund did not feel guilt in the conventional way. What flickered was closer to discomfort, the specific discomfort of a man who expected a scene and has been denied one, and doesn't entirely know what to do with that. "Good morning," Eloan said, without looking up from her letter. "Good morning." Edmund moved to the sideboard, poured himself coffee. He was watching her. Waiting for it. "There are kippers," she said. "And the post brought something from your solicitors, I've left it on your desk." Edmund poured his coffee. Watched her read. Waited some more. "Nothing. Cecily will be joining us for," he began. "I've already spoken with Cook," Eloan said, turning a page. "A full breakfast will be available until 11. Another pause. Edmund sat down across the table, stirring his coffee with the air of a man who had prepared for a battle and arrived to find the other side had apparently gone on holiday. "You seem," he said carefully, "remarkably composed."
"I'm always composed," Eloan said.
She looked up then, and she smiled at him. Not warmly. Not coldly. Just, clearly. The way you look at something you understand completely. "Edmund, I think we should have a conversation this afternoon. Shall we say 3 o'clock? The library." He blinked. "About several things." She folded her letter. Stood, smoothing her skirt. "I've asked Mr. Pemberton to be present. And my solicitor, Mr. Howe. Is there anyone you'd like to have there?" The coffee cup stopped halfway to his mouth. "Your solicitor. And Mr. Pemberton, yes. You've met him. Lovely man. Very thorough." She moved toward the door, pausing beside him. Up close, he could see that she was entirely, absolutely, architecturally calm. No redness around the eyes. No tension in the jaw. She had the face of a woman who had already been through the worst of it and come out on the other side some time ago. "Shall I send a message to your man, or will you contact him yourself?" Edmund stared at her. "Right," she said pleasantly. "I'll have Alderton send word. 3 o'clock, then." She walked out. Edmund sat very still for approximately 30 seconds. Then he put his coffee cup down, stood up, and went to find his solicitor's card. Lady Cecily came downstairs at 10:30, dressed now in one of her own gowns, which was the kind of gown that announced itself before she did, deep burgundy, cut in the newest continental fashion, designed to make every other woman in the room feel that her wardrobe had personally let her down. She was, objectively, beautiful. She had the kind of face that painters argued over and husbands ruined themselves for, and she knew it the way a surgeon knows exactly where the artery runs, with professional precision. She swept into the morning room and found it empty except for a play setting, a pot of tea, and a small vase of flowers. She blinked. She had been expecting, she wasn't quite sure what. Cold silence. A weeping duchess. Possibly a thrown candlestick. What she had not been expecting was hospitality. She sat down slowly, poured tea, and looked around the room as though it might give her information the absence of a scene wasn't providing. Mrs. Alderton appeared in the doorway. "Good morning, my lady. Shall I bring eggs?" Cecily looked at her. "Where is the Duchess?" "Her Grace is attending to correspondence, my lady. She asked me to ensure you had everything you required." A pause? "She did." "Yes, my lady. Eggs?" Cecily stared at the tea in her cup. "Yes. Eggs." What Cecily Montrose did not understand, what she had never understood, because no one had ever thought to explain it to her and she had never had reason to learn it herself, was that the truly dangerous response to betrayal is not fury. Fury is loud and honest and legible. You can navigate around fury. You can apologize your way past it, charm your way through it, outlast it. Composure is different. Composure is a locked room where you can hear someone moving around on the other side and you have absolutely no idea what they are doing. Cecily ate her eggs. The kippers were excellent. She told herself this meant nothing. She looked out the window at the garden, which was immaculate, and told herself that too meant nothing. She drank her tea and tried to read Edmund's face when he came briefly to the doorway, said something about correspondence, and disappeared again with the vaguely hunted expression of a man who had just discovered that the chessboard has more pieces on it than he'd accounted for. Cecily ate her eggs. The kippers were excellent. She told herself this meant nothing. She looked out the window at the garden, which was immaculate, and told herself that too meant nothing. She drank her tea and tried to read Edmund's face when he came briefly to the doorway, said something about correspondence, and disappeared again with the vaguely hunted expression of a man who had just discovered that the chessboard has more pieces on it than he'd accounted for. The thing about Cecily Montrose, the thing even people who disliked her would have had to concede, if pressed, was that she was genuinely intelligent. Not in Eloan's architectural way, not the patient, systemic, document-reading kind of intelligence. Cecily's intelligence was reactive, adaptive, social. She read rooms. She read people. She had excellent instincts for the temperature of a situation, for when to push and when to retreat, for what someone wanted to hear versus what they needed to hear, and she deployed this intelligence with the skilled economy of a person who had grown up in circumstances that made it necessary. She had been reading this room since she walked into the breakfast table and found it set for her. The room was saying something she did not like. It was saying, "This is not a house in crisis. This is not a house where the woman upstairs has been broken by what she found out.
This is a house that is running exactly as it always runs, with the same precision and the same quiet competence, and the reason it is running that way is because the woman who runs it has not lost her grip on it for a single moment. Cecily set down her teacup. She had made a fundamental error, she was beginning to understand. She had looked at Eloan Ashford, Eloan Cavendish, born and raised and educated in the full weight of who she was, and she had seen a woman who did not fight back. She had seen the composure and called it passivity. She had seen the steadiness and called it resignation. She had been describing the symptoms of preparation. She had been watching someone build something and mistaken it for someone standing still. Outside, in the garden, Eloan was walking the path between the rose beds, reading a document, making small notations in the margins. A footman stood at a respectful distance, holding a leather satchel. Every few minutes, Eloan would hand him a page, he would slide it into the satchel, and she would turn to the next document. She had been out here for 40 minutes. She was almost done. At 3 o'clock precisely, they gathered in the library. Edmund had his personal solicitor, a Mr. Terence Blythe, who was the kind of solicitor that expensive, careless men kept on retainer, well-dressed, aggressively confident, and specifically skilled at making problems disappear before they could be properly examined. Blythe had been handling Edmund's affairs for 6 years and had the comfortable posture of a man who expected this meeting to be an irritating formality. He had arrived with a leather briefcase, a practiced air of authority, and the specific preparedness of someone who has been briefed on the situation and believes he understands it. He did not understand it. Eloan had Mr. Howe, who was 63 years old, had the general appearance of a man who had been carved from old wood, and had been her father's solicitor before hers. He spoke rarely. When he did, it was with the clipped, precise economy of a man who charged by the word and would not waste a single one. Beside him, Mr. Pemberton from the estate solicitors, who was younger, slightly nervous, and kept looking at the stack of documents in front of Eloan the way a man looks at a storm forming on the horizon of an open plain. Edmund sat at the far end of the table, flanked by Blythe, wearing the expression of a man who had convinced himself he was in control of this meeting. He was not in control of this meeting. He had never been in control of this meeting. The meeting had been Eloan's from the moment she announced it. Eloan sat at the near end, her hands folded on top of the document stack, and she looked at her husband the way a surgeon looks at a scan, not with emotion, but with diagnostic clarity, and she said, "Shall we begin?" Blythe, with the practiced friendliness of a man trying to establish tone early, opened with an observation about the nature of the proceedings being, surely, preliminary and informal, and suggested that any matters of significance could be better handled at a later date when all parties had had time to reflect. "This is not preliminary," Mr. Howe said, without looking up from his papers. Just those 5 words. He did not elaborate. He did not need to. The words had the weight of a door being closed. Blythe recalibrated. He tried again. What followed was 3 hours. "I am not going to give you all 3 hours, because we would be here until next week, but I am going to give you the important parts, which came in 3 distinct and increasingly spectacular waves. The first wave was the financial situation." Mr. Pemberton walked Edmund through the audit results. The Eastern Holdings deficit. The collateral shortfall. The gap between projected income and actual income, which, presented in black and white with supporting figures, looked like a very steep cliff. Edmund's face, initially constructed for confident denial, began to lose its scaffolding around page 3. It was the specificity that was devastating. Not the broad outlines. A man can argue with broad outlines, can suggest alternative interpretations, can perform skepticism and buy time. It was the figures. Line by line, year by year, with documentation. The assessor's report, which put current values on the Eastern holdings that were unambiguously, uncomfortably lower than the collateral figures against which Edmund had been borrowing for 4 years. The bank correspondence, which Mr. Howe laid on the table with the quiet unhurriedness of someone dealing cards they've been holding for a while. The reconciliation of what had been reported versus what had actually occurred, which showed Harold Fitch, Edmund's man of business, who had been such a comfortable fixture of Edmund's financial life that Edmund had essentially stopped looking at numbers because Harold was handling numbers, to have been, for 4 consecutive years, describing a much rosier situation than the situation that actually existed. Blythe intervened at several points. He was good. He had the practiced fluency of a man who had talked his way around bad numbers before. He suggested alternative interpretations, question methodology, introduce doubt with the efficiency of someone whose entire career was built on manufacturing it. He raised questions about the assessor's methodology. He suggested the reconciliation figures were preliminary. He used the phrase, one interpretation among several, twice in 6 minutes, which was impressive. Mr. Howe let him finish each time. Then, without raising his voice, without shifting his expression, he produced the counter-evidence. The assessor's credentials. The reconciliation methodology, explained in writing by a second independent accountant. The bank's own figures, subpoenaed through entirely proper channels by Mr. Pemberton's office, which had the significant advantage of being the bank's own figures and therefore extremely difficult to describe as one interpretation among several. By the end of the first hour, Blythe had stopped intervening. By the end of the second, Edmund had stopped looking confident and started looking like a man doing the specific kind of arithmetic that gives you the answer before you finish the equation and you don't want the answer. The second wave was the trust. This was where Aloan spoke directly for the first time since opening the meeting. She had been, until this moment, present in the manner of a general who has deployed her officers and is watching from high ground, entirely in command, visibly unnecessary for the individual maneuvers but absolutely central to the whole. When she spoke, the room shifted in the specific way rooms shift when the person who is actually in charge decides to address it directly. She explained, calmly, the terms of the Cavendish Trust. She explained the amendment on page 31. She explained the clause regarding marital abandonment. She explained the three affidavits from household staff that were now in Mr. Howe's possession. She explained that the trust, effective as of this morning, was under her sole management direction, and that she had yesterday instructed the trustees to cease the quarterly distributions to the joint household account. The room was very quiet. Blythe had opened his mouth, but nothing was coming out. This was because page 31 was in front of him. Aloan had provided copies for everyone, with the relevant clause neatly underlined in a precise, steady hand, and he was reading it for the second time with the expression of a man discovering that the map he has been following has an entire additional continent on it that someone simply hadn't mentioned. Edmund said, "You can't." "I can," Aloan said. She didn't say it triumphantly. She said it the way you confirm a fact. The amended contract, page 31, clause 7, paragraph 3. "You have a copy. Mr. Blythe has a copy. I have had Mr. Howe prepare an additional copy for your convenience." She slid a document down the table. Edmund looked at Blythe. Blythe picked up the document. "Read it." Put it back down with the careful movements of a man trying not to let anyone see that he had just swallowed something unpleasant. "When," Blythe said, clearing his throat, "was this amendment executed?" "Year 2 of the marriage," Mr. Howe said, with the serenity of a man describing the weather. "Filed at the appropriate registry. Entirely regular. Would you like the filing number?" Blythe glanced at Edmund. "No. Thank you." Edmund, for his part, had gone the color of old plaster. He was looking at the document the way you look at something that was always there and you are now, for the first time, actually seeing. "You signed it," Aloan said to him. Her voice was not unkind, but it was completely clear. A glass of cold water on a clear day. "You described the papers as administrative. I believe your word was routine." "I had Mr. Howe explain every clause before I signed, as I always do." "You signed after me. That is your signature." She pointed, with one finger, to the bottom of the page. Edmund looked at his own signature. There is a very particular feeling, I suspect most of us have experienced some version of it, when you are confronted with evidence of a decision your past self made that your present self would very much like to undo, and you realize you can't undo it because it was legal and witnessed and filed in a registry and is currently being read aloud to you in a library by the person whose interests it protects. Edmund was having that feeling. He was having it in a very concentrated form. The third wave was Cavendish House. This was the one that made Edmund go completely still. Cavendish House was not, in itself, financially significant. It was a handsome country house in Wiltshire, 6 bedrooms, good grounds, pleasant outlook, the kind of place that features in watercolors and attracts favorable comments from visitors without being spectacular. What it was, more importantly, was Eloan's. Entirely, inarguably, legally hers, held in her name since the death of her father, never commingled with the Blackmore estate, never mortgaged, never touched. It had never been discussed as an asset or a resource or anything other than Eloan's childhood home, to which she occasionally returned for a few days in the summer when the season permitted. It was also, as Edmund now understood, fully staffed and in complete readiness, because Eloan had been ensuring that it was for the past 3 months. She was moving there. Not immediately. Not in a dramatic midnight flight. In 3 weeks, in an orderly, organized manner, with her personal effects, her grandmother's china, her library, her correspondence files, and Mrs. Alderton, who had informed Eloan the previous evening that she was putting in her notice from Ashford Manor and would very much appreciate a position at Cavendish House if one were available. She had also, Eloan mentioned with the same calm she'd had throughout, arranged for Thomas the head footman to assist with the logistics of the removal, should that be acceptable. Thomas had volunteered. She had told him it would not be necessary. He had said, and she relayed this with the slight warmth of something that still moved her, that he was aware it wasn't necessary, but that he wanted to help. "You're leaving," Edmund said. "I'm relocating," Eloan said. She was so steady. If she were a building, you couldn't have found a crack in her. "This is my formal notification, as required under Clause 12 of the marriage contract, that I am exercising my right to separate residence under grounds of marital misconduct. The legal filing will be submitted to Chancery by end of week." Edmund had gone the color of old chalk. "Eloan, there is a fourth item," she said, and this time something did move across her face, not pain, not anger, but something older and quieter, like the expression of someone closing a door they had lived behind for a long time. "The railway shares and the textile holdings are mine outright, never placed in joint name, and I've arranged for them to be formally registered in my sole name as a precaution. Mr. Howe has the documentation. This is not a negotiation, Edmund. This is a notification." She stood. The room did not stand with her in the servile way rooms sometimes do for powerful people. It simply stayed where it was, and she was simply above it, and the distinction was important. "I trust," she said, gathering her documents with the same care she'd used setting down the breakfast tray in the hall this morning, "that everyone has what they need." She walked to the door. Stopped with her hand on the frame. Did not turn around. "Edmund," she said. He looked up. "The kippers this morning were excellent. I'll leave Cook's recipe with Mrs. Alderton before I go. You'll want to hire a new housekeeper. I'd recommend someone with experience of large establishments. A breath? I hope you find what you're looking for." She left. The door closed behind her, not quite a slam, but firmly. Decisively. With finality. In the library, three men stared at the closed door, and one man stared at the table, and the silence in that room was the particular silence of an outcome that no one except one person had seen coming, and that one person was already halfway down the hall. In the library, three men stared at the closed door, and one man stared at the table, and the silence in that room was the particular silence of an outcome that no one except one person had seen coming, and that one person was already halfway down the hall. Mr. Pemberton gathered his papers carefully. Mr. Howe was already done gathering his, because he had been prepared for this outcome and had organized accordingly. Blythe sat for a moment longer, looking at the document stack where it had been, with the expression of a professional confronting a professional loss, not the defeat itself, but the recognition of what the defeat represented. He had been retained to protect Edmund's interests. He had been given incomplete information about what Edmund's interests actually were, and specifically about what had been quietly arranged around and beneath them. He had walked into a library expecting to manage a marital dispute and had instead observed the controlled detonation of a situation that had been prepared for 3 years, not aggressively, not maliciously, but with the quiet inevitability of a structure being built to code and then, when required, simply activated. He stood. He nodded to Mr. Howe, who returned it fractionally. He left. Edmund sat alone. He was still sitting alone when the clock on the mantelpiece struck 5. The social world moves faster than the legal one, which is saying something because the legal one moves at approximately the speed of cold treacle. But society, specifically the world of titled households and county families and London drawing rooms and who knows what about whom, has an information network that would humble most intelligent services. By the following week, the news of the Duchess's departure from Ashford Manor was everywhere. Not the details, nobody had the details, because everyone with the details was either professionally obligated to silence or personally loyal to Eloan, but the outline. The broad shape. The Duchess had left. She was at Cavendish House. The separation proceedings had been filed. This information moved through drawing rooms and correspondence with the specific velocity of things people find both shocking and, if they are honest with themselves, not entirely surprising. There is a category of social news that operates this way. When it arrives, it is news, but it is the kind of news that, as people process it, they find they already knew some version of was possible. That they had noticed things. That there had been comments, not quite made, and observations, put aside because it wasn't their business, and questions that nobody had wanted to ask. The general social verdict on Lady Cecily was not kind. She had miscalculated in a way that people found, and this is very specific to the world she moved in, not just wrong, but foolish, which in that world is considerably worse. Wrong can be forgiven. Foolish is remembered. She had overplayed her hand so dramatically, had been so visibly confident in a strategy that had collapsed so completely, that the sympathy extended to women in difficult situations was largely absent and the quiet satisfaction of people watching a miscalculation play out was largely present. There was one story in particular that circulated, I cannot confirm its absolute accuracy, but it was widely reported and widely believed, which in social terms amounts to the same thing, about a dinner party at Lord and Lady Hartwick's house, approximately a month after the separation was filed, at which Lady Cecily was present and at which, three separate people at three separate points in the evening, made polite inquiries about the Duchess and expressed warm regard for her, knowing perfectly well what they were doing, as did everyone in the room. Each time, Cecily had smiled and said something pleasant and unrevealing, as was correct. But by the third inquiry, her smile had a quality to it that one observer described as a woman wearing a mask that has been slightly dented. The Duchess, for her part, was not at that dinner party. She was in Wiltshire, running her school and her accounts and her life, completely unaware of these particular skirmishes being conducted on her behalf and absolutely not requiring them. Which was, several observers noted, characteristic. She had never needed the social world to fight for her. She had done her own fighting, with paperwork, over the course of 8 months, before anyone knew there was a fight happening. This impressed people. Even, perhaps especially, people who had been slow to take her seriously when she was simply Edmund's wife. There is a specific kind of retrospective appreciation that attaches to people who turn out to have been more than you thought, not admiration for what they did in the moment, but the recalibrated understanding of who they were all along, which reframes every memory of them you have. People thought back to Eloan at dinners, at functions, at social occasions over 6 years, and they revisited her with new information, and they found, each one of them, in their own way, that the information fit perfectly with everything they remembered, and that the only person who had not seen what was there to be seen had been the Duke. Edmund, at his club one evening in October, was asked by an acquaintance how he was getting on. He said, "Fine, thank you, very well indeed, as one does." The acquaintance said, and managed to make it sound genuinely friendly, "She's a remarkable woman, your Duchess." "Yes," Edmund said, after a pause that was not quite natural in length. "She is. Always was," the acquaintance said, in the tone of a man delivering a message he knows will land. "Remarkable from the start." Edmund took a drink of his port. He did not say anything else. "Now, let's talk about Lady Cecily. Because here is the thing about Cecily Montrose that Edmund had never properly understood, possibly because he had been too busy being enchanted to examine. She was not, at her core, a woman in love. She was a woman in strategy. She had identified Edmund as an excellent vehicle for the destination she wanted, which was this house, this title, this position, and she had pursued him with the focused energy of a business person pursuing a contract. The problem with that strategy was that it had always depended on one variable she hadn't fully accounted for, which was the incumbent Duchess being the kind of woman who would simply crumble and retreat, leaving the field clear. Cecily had badly, catastrophically misread the incumbent Duchess. After the library meeting, Edmund went to find Cecily in the sitting room where she'd been waiting. He came in, poured himself a drink without offering her one, a small signal she filed away, and sat down with the face of a man whose mental map of his situation had just revealed that all the roads he thought were roads were in fact walls. "There's a financial issue," he said. Cecily waited. He told her about the audit. The shortfall. The collateral. He told her in the stripped-down, too quiet way of a man who had stopped trying to make things sound better than they were, which in itself told her everything she needed to know about how bad it was. Cecily was quiet for a very long moment. "How bad?" she asked. "Bad," he said. "Can it be resolved?" "With time." "How much time?" Edmund drank his drink. "Years." Another silence. "Longer." Here is what Cecily was calculating, rapidly, behind the smooth and beautiful face. She had spent 11 months on this. She had spent social capital, she had spent time, She had spent the accumulated effort of a campaign that had been her primary occupation and had required genuine sacrifice. There were invitations she had declined, connections she had put on hold, other options she had quietly let expire. She had, to put it plainly, bet a great deal on Edmund Ashford being an excellent investment. And now she was looking at the balance sheet and finding it short. "What does she take?" Cecily asked. Edmund knew exactly who she was talking about. The Cavendish Trust. The railway shares. The textile interests. Cavendish House. "What does that leave for the estate?" He named a number. Cecily did not visibly react. But in her chest, something that had been bright and upright very quietly sat down. That number was not what she had been planning for. That number was not the life in London and Paris and the autumn parties and the spring estates and the position she had been building toward. That number was a smaller, quieter, more difficult life. Not poverty, she was not being dramatic, but not the life she'd been reaching for. She had reached across a table and grabbed what she thought was the best piece of fruit, and it turned out to be a very convincing wax replica. "I see," she said. Edmund was watching her with the expression of a man slowly understanding something he really should have understood a long time ago. Over the following weeks, as the legal process began its stately, expensive, unforgiving progress, several things happened in the world of the Blackmore Ashford social circle that are worth noting. The first was that Cecily Montrose's visits to Ashford Manor became less frequent, then infrequent, then, by the third week after Eloan's departure, stopped entirely. Lady Cecily was seen instead at various London events, increasingly in the company of Lord Whitfield, who was an older widower with a perfectly solvent estate and the kind of uncomplicated temperament that, after 11 months of strategic warfare, probably felt like a very warm bath. She had revised her portfolio. She had made a pragmatic decision. One could not even, entirely, blame her. Edmund, watching this development from the great empty rooms of Ashford Manor, which felt significantly larger now that it contained only him and a reduced staff, began to experience a specific kind of education that only comes from having everything you took for granted carefully, legally, and permanently removed. He hired a new solicitor. Then a second one. They told him, with varying degrees of gentleness, what Mr. Howe had told him in that library, that the marriage contract amendments were binding, that the trust reversion was legal, that the marital abandonment clause was clear, and that the Duchess of Blackmore had, and this is a direct quote from the second solicitor, who was paying rather more attention than the first, prepared this with exceptional thoroughness. Exceptional thoroughness. The man had said it like a compliment. Edmund supposed, looking at the ruins of his financial assumptions from every angle, that it was. At Cavendish House in Wiltshire, 3 weeks after the library meeting, a different kind of life was being assembled. It arrived the way good things sometimes do, quietly, piece by piece, without fanfare, each element fitting the one before it until suddenly you look up and realize that the thing you're standing inside is not a temporary shelter but a home. Mrs. Alderton supervised the arrangement of furniture with the focused efficiency of a woman who had been waiting years for a household she could actually approve of. She reorganized the kitchen within the first 4 days and told cook, in terms that brooked zero ambiguity, exactly how she expected things to be done. Cook, who had followed Eloan from Ashford Manor, adapted immediately. They were, within the week, operating with the synchronized harmony of people who had found their correct context. The library at Cavendish House was smaller than the one at Ashford Manor, but it was Eloan's. Every book on those shelves she had chosen. Every document in the filing cabinet she had read. The writing desk faced a window overlooking the South Garden, and in the mornings the light came in at an angle that turned the pages of whatever she was reading gold at the edges. She had brought the china. Her grandmother's china, the one she'd been so careful not to break in that hallway. She unpacked it herself, one piece at a time, setting it in the cabinet in the dining room where she could see it from the table. She had also brought something else. Not a physical object. Something that takes much longer to pack and is far more careful in its transportation. She had brought her own assessment of herself. In 6 years of marriage, living in Edmund's house, moving in Edmund's world, being introduced at Edmund's events and expected to reflect Edmund's status, some small erosion had taken place. Not dramatic. Not the kind of destruction you can point to. The slow, quiet kind, where you don't notice it happening because you're busy and because the world keeps moving and because the alternative, stopping, looking, measuring, feels dangerous. Now, in the small library at Cavendish House with the gold-edged morning light and her grandmother's china visible through the dining room door, she stopped. She looked. She measured. What she found, to her own slight surprise, was more than she'd thought. She began corresponding again with the women she'd allowed to drift during the years of managing Edmund's social world, which had been all-consuming and had left very little room for anyone not directly useful to Edmund's agenda. Letters went out to three old friends, two distant cousins, and, in a small act of pure defiance, her former governess, now retired in Bath, who had been the first person to tell her that she had an exceptional legal mind and should have been a barrister if the world weren't so tediously organized against it. She took up again the work she'd set aside, the charity school she'd been funding quietly, which operated in two villages near the estate and provided education to children who would otherwise have had none. She had been managing this at a distance during the marriage. Now she drove out to both villages in the second week of her residence and introduced herself to the headmistresses and the children and the parents, and spent two afternoons sitting in on lessons and coming away with three pages of notes and a renewed sense of purpose that felt like blood returning to a limb that had been numb. She also, in the fourth week, received a visitor. His name was Mr. Charles Devereux. He was a barrister of some note in London, 41 years old, with the kind of face that suggested he had been through things and come out of them with his character intact, which is a much rarer quality than it sounds. He was not conventionally handsome in the way Edmund had been. He didn't have Edmund's effortless social radiance, the kind that makes a room rearrange itself around a person's arrival. He walked into rooms and became, quietly, their most dependable feature. The person you noticed on the second look rather than the first, and then could not stop noticing. As the second son of the Earl of Marlowe, he had no prospect of the title, had taken the bar exam to the mild bafflement of his family, and had spent two decades building a legal reputation that was entirely his own, built on preparation, precision, and the specific quality of a man who never needed to perform because he simply always knew. He had argued before parliamentary committees. He had won cases that other barristers had declined to take. He had the respect of people whose respect was difficult to earn, which is the only kind of respect that is worth counting. He had been a friend of her father's. The old Viscount had liked him enormously, had described him in correspondence as the rare sort of man who understands that listening is a skill and practices it accordingly, and he had written to Eloan after her father's death with a genuine warmth that had nothing performative about it, and she had written back, and that had become a correspondence. The correspondence had been entirely proper and entirely friendly and had been, she now understood, the only consistent relationship in the past 6 years in which she had been treated as a person worth taking seriously on her own terms. He never addressed letters to her as the Duchess of Blackmore. He wrote to Miss Cavendish, her family name, the name she had carried before the marriage had added layers over it, which was either a casual oversight or an entirely deliberate statement, and knowing Charles Devereux, she was fairly certain it was the latter. He came to call because he happened to be in the county and had asked permission in a letter. She had given it. He arrived punctually, in a plain carriage, with no ceremony, and Mrs. Alderton showed him into the drawing room with the careful neutrality of a woman who had opinions she was prudently holding in reserve. He sat down. He drank tea. He talked to her for 3 hours about a case he had recently argued at the appellate level, about a book she had recommended months ago that had exceeded her description of it, about the railway legislation that they both thought was being handled with remarkable ineptitude, about the school in the village and the third headmistress who had written to Eloan with such affecting simplicity about what the mathematics lessons were doing for the children's self-understanding. He spoke to her the way her father had always spoken to her, as though her opinions were not just welcome but necessary, as though the conversation could not reach its proper shape without her contribution to it. And she gave him her opinions. The actual ones, not the managed versions. She told him she thought the appellate decision in his recent case had been correct on procedure and wrong on precedent. He listened without interrupting, then said, very directly, that she was right, and that he had thought the same, and that he was wondering whether there was a vehicle to appeal the precedent point. She said there might be, and described one. He took out a small notebook and wrote down what she said. She had not had anyone write down what she said in 6 years. The simplicity of the gesture, the uncomplicated assumption that what she said was worth recording, made something move in her chest that she absolutely did not investigate in the moment, being a woman who had developed a very sensible policy about examining things only when she had the time and privacy to do so properly. When he left, she stood at the window of the blue drawing room and watched the carriage go down the drive, and she felt something that took her a moment to identify because she had been without it for long enough that she had genuinely forgotten its particular texture. She felt like herself. Meanwhile, back at Ashford Manor. Ashford Manor in the weeks following the library meeting was developing the specific atmosphere of a very grand ship that has discovered a leak. Not yet sinking. But the internal climate had changed. The ballroom still gleamed. The gardens were still maintained by the same staff who'd always maintained them. The silver was still polished. But there was a quality to the place now, a subtle shift, the difference between a house that is being lived in and a house that is being occupied, and the people who work there felt it in the way that staff always feel things, in their bones, before their heads catch up. Mrs. Alderton's replacement, a Mrs. Graves, was competent. Efficient. Not unkind. But she had come from a household where the domestic management style was more military than domestic, and the staff who had stayed on found the adjustment bracing in the way that cold water is bracing, which is to say, technically invigorating, deeply unpleasant. Cook had gone with the Duchess. The new cook was fine. Fine was the operative word. The food at Ashford Manor became fine, which, for a house where cook had reigned for 11 years and the kippers had been genuinely extraordinary, represented a significant decline in lived experience. Edmund ate his fine meals at the long dining table, alone, and tried not to notice how different alone tasted. He noticed. A long table designed for a household of company is one of the lonelier objects in existence when there is only one person at it. Edmund had hosted dinners for 40. He had presided over breakfasts and lunches and late suppers with the easy mastery of a man who had always had someone else ensuring the table was set correctly, the guests were comfortable, the conversation moved with enough momentum to carry everyone pleasantly from course to course. He had never once, he now understood, thought about who was doing the ensuring. He sat at his end of the table, which had formerly been the far end from Eloan, and he noticed things that he had not previously had the occasion to notice, that the room was draughty in the upper corner by the east window, which had apparently been known and managed for years by means of a specific positioning of the curtain that Mrs. Graves had not yet learned. That the candlesticks on the second sideboard had always been replaced weekly, and that whoever was now doing this was doing it on a different schedule. That the flowers in the center arrangement had always been a specific seasonal selection that complemented the room and were now simply flowers, pleasant enough, but without the considered quality that had made you feel the room had been thought about. Small things. Individually negligible. Collectively, the difference between a house that was running and a house that was simply standing. He did not tell anyone this. There was no one to tell. That was its own answer. His financial situation, under the new constraints, required what his new solicitor euphemistically called restructuring, which meant he needed to sell things. Not catastrophically. Not the manor itself. But the horses, a stable he'd been deeply proud of, went in the fifth week. A property in Berkshire went in the seventh. His membership at two of the more expensive London clubs, which he had always considered as essential to his existence as air and coffee, was not renewed. He was not ruined. He kept telling himself this. He was not ruined. But he was reduced, and the gap between what he had been and what he was now was exactly the shape of the things he had not valued while he had them, which is the unkindest possible geometry. Lord Whitfield and Lady Cecily were seen together in Derbyshire in October. Engaged by November. The announcement in the papers was brief and decorous, and Edmund read it over his fine breakfast with his fine coffee and put the paper down and went to stand at the window overlooking his still immaculate, still beautiful estate, and had the private, reckoning kind of experience that a man has when he realizes that the mistakes he made were not the result of bad luck or circumstance but of choices, freely made, whose consequences had simply been waiting with infinite patience for him to arrive at them. He sat down. He wrote a letter. He crossed out the letter. He wrote another one. He sent neither. He was not, by nature, a man who apologized. He had been raised in a tradition that considered apology a form of weakness, which is the kind of tradition that works beautifully until the moment it catastrophically fails you, at which point you find yourself sitting alone in a very large house realizing that you have never once developed the skill most required by your situation. He wrote a third letter. He sent that one. The letter reached Cavendish House on a Thursday, in the late morning, in a batch of correspondence that also contained a note from the headmistress at the village school, favorable, a legal update from Mr. Howe, routine, and an interesting letter from a railway company about dividend adjustments, pleasing. Eloan read Edmund's letter last. It was 2 pages. The handwriting was more careful than his usual. He'd been deliberate about this, she could tell, the way you can tell when someone has written a letter 3 times before sending it. He said several things. He said he understood, now, the extent of what he'd done. He did not say he was sorry, not in those words. She didn't think he was capable of saying it in those words, and she found that she didn't require him to. He said that he had been a poor husband. He said that he had not understood, for a long time, that what he had in his house was not a decorative feature of his life but a person of extraordinary quality who had made his world significantly better than it deserved to be, and that he had not known how to value that while he had it. He said, and this part made her hold very still for a moment, that he hoped she was well. That he hoped she was happy. That he thought she would be, because she had always been the more capable of the two of them at constructing the things she needed. She sat with the letter for a while. Then she placed it in the filing cabinet, in the drawer labeled Ashford Correspondence, which was a label she had put there when she was still married and still hoping things might resolve differently, and which now served as a small private record of a chapter of her life that had taught her more than she had paid for and less than she might have wished. She locked the drawer. She went to have lunch. The legal separation proceedings concluded the following spring. It was a quiet affair, as these things go when both parties have excellent solicitors and no desire for a public spectacle. Edmund agreed to the terms without protracted negotiation, which was either wisdom or exhaustion or some combination that, by the end, had become indistinguishable. The settlement confirmed what the library meeting had already outlined: her trusts, her properties, her investments, her independence. The Duchess of Blackmore, the title she retained, for which there were complicated feelings, she addressed systematically the way she addressed everything, by examining them, categorizing them, and deciding which ones deserved her continued energy, left the proceedings with more than she'd had on the day she walked into that marriage at 23. Not dramatically more, but measurably, materially, undeniably more. Her father would have called it compound interest on good paperwork. She called it Tuesday. She drove back to Cavendish House in a carriage with the windows down, through the spring Wiltshire countryside, which was doing its best impression of something hopeful: green fields, white hawthorn hedges, the sky a particular shade of blue that seemed to be making a promise. She watched it pass. When she arrived home, Mrs. Alderton met her in the hall. "Tea's ready," Mrs. Alderton said, and her face said about 17 other things that could not be expressed in front of a footman. "Excellent," Eloan said. She handed over her gloves and her hat. Stopped. Turned. "Mrs. Alderton. Your Grace. Set out the china tonight for dinner. The good china." She paused. "It's been in the cabinet long enough." Mrs. Alderton pressed her lips together in that way she had. Then she nodded, once, and went to issue the relevant instructions. Eloan went upstairs to change. In the hallway, she passed the mirror, a long, gilt-framed thing that had been in this house since her childhood, that had shown her her own face at every stage of her life, and she stopped and looked at herself for a moment. No particular reason. Just to look. The face in the mirror looked back with the expression of a woman who had been tested, and had not been found wanting, and knew it. She went on. "Now, I want to take a moment and talk about what happened to both Edmund and Cecily in the long run. Because this is not the kind of story where people simply disappear once they have been dealt with. Real life has the decency, or the cruelty, depending on your perspective, to keep everyone in the same social world, bumping into each other at parties and concerts and charity events for years afterward, which is its own kind of reckoning. Edmund Ashford restructured. It took 4 years, and it was unglamorous, and it required the kind of sustained, unglamorous effort that he had spent his early life avoiding, but he did it. He hired a new man of business, a young, scrupulously honest man from Scotland who came to him on Mr. Pemberton's recommendation and who had, notably, absolutely no patience for optimistic projections. He sold the Berkshire property. He did not sell the manor. He brought the Eastern holdings back to profitability through the boring, painstaking, deeply unfashionable process of actually managing them instead of delegating management to someone whose incentives were not aligned with his. He did not remarry. Not from heartbreak. Edmund was not, fundamentally, the heartbroken type. He did not remarry because he had arrived, late and expensively, at a functioning understanding of his own limitations, and he was not confident that he had yet developed the character that marriage to anyone worthy required. This was, by most measures, the most adult thought he had ever had, and he had it at 36, which is late but not, he told himself, unreasonably so. He thought about Eloan occasionally. Not with longing, exactly. With something more complicated that didn't have a clean name in any language he'd been taught. Something that looked, from certain angles, like the understanding of a loss, and from others like the beginning of respect. He sent a brief note when her charity school expanded to a third village. She sent back an equally brief acknowledgement. They were not enemies. They were not quite anything that had a word, which seemed, all things considered, about right. Lady Cecily Montrose married Lord Whitfield in December, exactly as the papers had predicted. The wedding was large and fashionable and photographed for several periodicals, and Cecily wore an extraordinary gown and looked, in every picture, like a woman who had gotten exactly what she set out to get and was currently in the process of determining whether it was what she'd actually wanted. The answer, as far as anyone observing could determine, was, partially. Lord Whitfield was kind and solvent and genuinely fond of her, which she had not entirely banked on and found slightly disorienting, having grown accustomed to relationships with a more adversarial texture. The estate was handsome, the social position was good, the life was pleasant. She became, over the years, a competent and well-regarded hostess, and she developed, alongside the ambition that had always driven her, a kind of dry, self-aware humor about her own history that was, depending on who you asked, either wisdom or a useful defense mechanism. She ran into the Duchess once, at a London gallery opening, for years after everything. They were introduced by a mutual acquaintance who had apparently not thought through the implications. There was a short silence of the particular kind that contains a great deal of compressed history. Then Cecily said, "You look well." "Thank you," Eloan said. "So do you. I understand your school has been quite successful. We're rather proud of it." Another pause. "I suppose," Cecily said, with the careful deliberateness of a woman choosing her words like she was navigating ice, "that I ought to say something." "You're not obliged to," Eloan said. "I know. I—" Cecily stopped. "Tried again. I underestimated you." Eloan looked at her for a moment. "Yes," she said. "You did. Not unkindly. Not warmly. Simply, in the same way she said everything, as a fact." Cecily gave a small, slightly rueful nod. "Well, enjoy the exhibition." "You too." They separated into the gallery crowd and did not speak again that evening, but Cecily stood in front of a landscape painting for a long time afterward thinking about what it means to underestimate someone, and how it is almost never a mistake about the other person and almost always a mistake about yourself. In the fifth year after the separation, something happened at Cavendish House. It was spring again. There is something about spring in this story that insists on returning, which seems appropriate, spring being what it is, and Eloan had been living her life in a way that she found, to her continuing mild surprise, genuinely satisfying. The school was thriving. She had expanded it twice and was in discussion with two neighboring landowners about a third expansion. She had also, in the previous year, published under her own name, not a pseudonym, her actual name, which was its own small act of defiance, a monograph on the legal structures governing charitable trusts, which had been read by approximately 47 people in its initial circulation and had then been cited in a parliamentary committee report, which was more influence than most published monographs achieved. Mr. Howe had formally retired, and she had retained his junior partner, a young woman called Miss Frances Clare, who had passed the bar the previous year and who reminded Eloan, with some regularity and considerable warmth, of herself at 23, which is to say, formidably capable and not yet fully aware of it. The charity work had expanded to include a small fund for women in legal difficulty who could not afford representation, which had been Mr. Devereux's idea and which they had developed in conversation over the previous 2 years of a friendship that had grown, with the patience and care that good things require, into something neither of them had entirely planned for and both of them, at various stages, had been attempting not to look at directly. Charles Devereux came to Cavendish House in May, not as a casual visitor this time. He wrote a letter, which she read three times, and then replied to, and then he came. He sat in the drawing room with the gold afternoon light falling across the table between them, and he was quite direct, because he was a man whose profession required directness and who had, in addition, grown up in a family that considered the indirect approach to important conversations to be a form of cowardice. He said, he was aware of her history. He was aware of what she had been through and what it had cost her and what she had built in its aftermath, and he had no desire to introduce anything into her life that she did not want there. He said, he was not asking for anything she was not willing to give, and if the answer was no, he would go back to London and remain her friend, and that would be enough because she was an exceptional person and her friendship was already more than he'd expected from life. He said, and this is the part that mattered, the part she turned over in her mind afterward the way you turn over a stone and find something alive under it, that he had never once, in 5 years of knowing her, thought about who she was in relation to anyone else. not as a duchess, not as Edmund's wife, not as a figure in a social situation. Simply as herself. As the person who read three newspapers before breakfast and remembered everything and had an exceptional legal mind and cared deeply about children being educated and had a smile, not the polite one, that she kept for moments that deserved it, and that he found himself, when he was away from it, thinking about it the way you think about a room you want to return to. Eloan listened. She was quiet for a moment. Then she said, "You should know that I have extremely high standards." "I assumed," he said. "And I don't make decisions quickly." "I know. And I intend to keep my house and my work and my name exactly as they are." "Obviously," he said, and the way he said it, the absolute unconcerned, immediate obviously, made something in her chest relax that she hadn't realized she'd been holding tense. "Good," she said. "Then we can discuss it." She paused. "Have some tea first. Mrs. Alderton will send it in." He had tea. They discussed it. Mrs. Alderton, listening from the hallway with absolutely no shame whatsoever, went back to the kitchen with the expression of a woman who has been waiting a long time for something and has finally, gratifyingly, had the patience rewarded. She told cook to put out the good biscuits. They married the following spring. Quietly. A small ceremony at the church in the village nearest Cavendish House, attended by 20 people, all of whom were specifically chosen because they were the people who had actually mattered, consistently, over time, no performance, no display, no social arithmetic. Eloan wore a dress she had chosen herself in a color that suited her and that she liked, which sounds unremarkable and was, in the context of her first wedding, in the context of the dress that had been selected by committee and approved by Edmund's mother, an extraordinary liberty. The china was on the table at the wedding breakfast. Her grandmother would have approved. Miss Frances Clare served as a witness. Mrs. Alderton cried, which she would have vigorously denied if anyone had mentioned it, so no one did. Charles wore the expression of a man who had been dealt a better hand than he deserved and knew it and was resolved to play it with everything he had. Eloan looked, at 35, exactly like herself. Which is the highest compliment I know how to pay. Let me tell you what I think is the real story here. Not the betrayal, though that is real. Not the legal maneuvering, though that is what made the whole thing possible. Not even the ending, though the ending is genuinely lovely and it deserves everything I said about it. The real story is what Eloan did in those 8 months. 8 months of staying quiet. 8 months of not breaking down, not confronting, not satisfying the completely reasonable fury that must have been present, somewhere under all that composure. 8 months of building, piece by piece, the architecture of her own liberation, while living in the same house as the man who had decided she didn't matter enough to be faithful to. That is not patience. Patience is passive. What Eloan did was something else. Something that requires you to take your pain and your humiliation and your completely legitimate desire to throw something at someone and turn all of it into fuel, into precision, into the focused, forward-moving energy of a person who has decided that the best revenge is not a scene. The best revenge is a life. The best revenge is standing in your own house, in the morning light, with your grandmother's china on the table and a husband who looks at you like you are the answer to every question he has ever asked, and knowing, knowing in your bones and your history and your legal filings, that you built this. That this is yours. That nobody gave it to you and nobody can take it. The best revenge is being Eloan Cavendish. Who read the contract? Who read the amendment? Who read page 31? And who knew, when she put that silver breakfast tray down in the hallway, that she had already won, not because she had beaten anyone, but because she had, with exceptional thoroughness and considerable patience, simply made it impossible to lose. Edmund Ashford spent a great many years being a cautionary tale, which is the fate of men who mistake charm for character. He is, in certain circles, still referred to, not as the Duke, not by his title, but simply as the man who was married to Eloan Cavendish and failed to understand what that meant until it was documented in 47 pages of amended contract and filed in Chancery. Lady Cecily, Lady Whitfield now, is considered a competent and occasionally sharp-tongued hostess whose parties are well attended and whose opinions are worth hearing. She has, over the years, developed the kind of reputation that starts as infamy and eventually, if you live right and work hard and treat your current husband better than you treated the last institution you tried to commandeer, softens into character. Mr. Howe retired to the coast. He took up fishing and reportedly found it deeply unsatisfying compared to contract law, which says something about the kind of person he was and the kind of work that gave his life meaning. Miss Frances Clare, in her third year as Eloan's solicitor, argued a precedent-setting case before a parliamentary committee on behalf of the Charitable Trust Fund, citing the Cavendish Trust framework, and won. She wrote alone a letter about it that was 3 pages long and entirely professional and contained, in its final paragraph, the sentence, "I have been thinking about what it means to build something that outlasts the situation that made it necessary, and I think the answer might be that it becomes its own reason." Ilowen kept that letter in the drawer labeled Things Worth Keeping, which was the other drawer, the one she opened more often, the one that contained her father's last letter to her, and a drawing one of the schoolchildren had made of the schoolhouse, and a note Charles had written her on an ordinary Wednesday for no reason except that he had thought of something she'd like to know. At Cavendish House, the mornings were still golden. The china was still on the table. The school was still running. Mrs. Alderton was still Mrs. Alderton, which is a category unto itself. Charles Devereux, for his part, was exactly who he had always been, a man who listened well, wrote things down when they mattered, and had understood from very early on that he had married someone worth understanding. He told her so, periodically, not in sweeping declarations but in the specific, quiet way of someone who means what they say and knows the value of precision. "You were right about the third argument," or "I've been thinking about what you said about the school accounts and I think you should write that up," or, on one particular evening in the library with the fire going and the Wiltshire dark settled outside the windows, simply, "You are the most interesting person I have ever known." He said it the way you state something that has been obvious for years and finally needed saying. She had put her book down and looked at him for a moment. Then she said, "I know." He laughed. She did too. And the sound of it, the easy, unperformed, entirely private sound of two people laughing together in their own house on an ordinary evening, was the best sound that house had heard in a very long time, and the walls, which had heard a great deal over the years, knew it. And Ilowen Devereux, nay Cavendish, formerly Ashford, once and always the smartest person in the room, read her 3 newspapers before breakfast, remembered everything she read, and lived, with completeness, with purpose, with the particular satisfaction of a person who has built exactly the life she intended, extraordinarily well. And that, as they say, is how you read page 31.